To start off tonight's lecture, I would like to take you to the very end of the 15th century and to the German city of Erfurt in present-day Thuringia. More specifically, I'm taking you to the Benedictine monastery of Saints Peter and Paul, also known as St. Peter's Abbey, where from the 2nd to the 4th of September 1481, the members of the Boesfelder congregation gathered for their annual general chapter. Named after the monastery of Boesfelde in Lower Saxony, founded by Count Henry of Nordheim in 1093, the Boesfelder congregation was a major confederation of Reformed Benedictine monasteries established at the very beginning of the 15th century. Initially, the congregation's sphere of influence had been limited to the territories now known as Western and Central Germany, though within a few decades it also established important footholds in present-day Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and even Denmark. At the beginning of the 16th century, the congregation comprised well over 90 monasteries spread across different territories, and it would continue to grow steadily thereafter. Joining the congregation in 1450, Erfurt had been amongst the first major wave of churches incorporated into the Confederation, though St. Peter's Abbey itself had in fact been founded centuries earlier, between 1060 and 1080, when an existing community of secular canons was reformed and converted into a Benedictine monastery. Like Erfurt, most of the monasteries who joined the Boesfelder congregation during the 15th and early 16th centuries were not recent establishments, but most of them had been founded during the early and central Middle Ages. In order to communicate their ambitious religious and political vision and monitor the same vision's local implementation across an ever greater geographical area, the leaders of the Boesfelder congregation relied on an instrument of ecclesiastical governance known as the General Chapter. First summoned in 1446 and held in theory once a year thereafter, and in practice at least every other year, the General Chapter was a gathering of all the abbots ruling over one or more of the Confederation's affiliated communities. If, for whatever reason, the abbot himself was unable to attend, he was at liberty to send a provost or deputy in his place. The administration of the General Chapter usually fell to the president of the congregation, who was himself an abbot of one of the affiliated monasteries, and depending on the length of this abbacy, the presidency could be held by the same person for several decades. In 1481, the office of president, and thus the duty to preside over Erfurt's General Chapter, belonged to Abbot Theodoric of Homburg, who had been abbot of Boesfelde for 12 years. The chapter at Erfurt was well attended, with 42 abbots present and only 10 sending their apologies and assigned representatives. This was the highest turnout at any general chapter since records began in 1446, and it would not be exceeded until the gathering at Cologne in 1493. On the agenda were various items, only one of which should concern us this evening. The case that was put up for discussion and debate at Erfurt had been given the short and programmatic title De Historia Studio et Utilitate, in English, on the study of history and its usefulness. The author was Gunther of Nordhausen, who since 1458 had been Erfurt's abbot. Gunther had written a draft of On the Study of History and Its Usefulness in January 1481 and ordered for copies to be distributed amongst his fellow abbots prior to the September meeting. At the general chapter, the same text was then read out in front of everyone. The tone of Gunther's treatise oscillates between that of a sermon and that of an admonition, and the contemporary sources regularly refer to it as paranesis, which we may translate as a ticking off or dressing down. Opening with a parable, the treatise quickly launches into criticism aimed at the author's peers. He who compares history with the sun will soon realise that just as the sun gives life to everything dwelling on land, in the water and in the air, history likewise provides stability, certainty, and authority to all aspects of the communal life. Just as there cannot be light without the sun, without history, there cannot be community. Without history, man is not man, monks are not monks. Sine historia, homo non est homo, sine ea non sumus monachi. Running through Gunther's treatise, we can detect a sophisticated vision of the human being, and specifically the monk, as a creature made and absorbed by a sense of history. History, according to this vision, is life's headmistress, historia magistra vitae, to quote the classical trope. The monk who learns from history's lessons is seen as fulfilling his divine calling, and through his own example, he will inspire others to lead a good and righteous life. On the other hand, those who disrespect history stand accused of acting contrary to their nature and, by implication, sinning against their creator. He who rejects and remains ignorant of historical study is condemned as the beastliest of beasts. Omni bestia bestialior erit. Similar thoughts had been expressed by writers of earlier centuries using strikingly similar terminology. Take, for example, Henry of Huntingdon, a 12th century English historian and archdeacon from the Diocese of Lincoln. In his History of the English, in Latin, Historia Anglorum, Henry argues that the study of history distinguishes rational creatures, rationabiles, from beasts or brutes, brutus. The reason being that the latter, be they humans or animals, do not know, nor do they care to know, about their origins, where they came from, the events of the past more generally, or even their own relative location within the passing of time. According to Henry, such ignorance and indifference can be excused in animals, given that it represents their natural state of being and must therefore be expected. In humans, by contrast, the same ignorance was a sign of bestiality and evil. 400 years later, in the mid-16th century, Philip Melanchthon argued in a similar vein when, during one of his lectures at the University of Wittenberg, he stated that God wants us to know history. Deus vult nos scire historias. In the same lecture, he doubled down on this notion by adding that he who does not derive pleasure from knowing history is but a beast in pasture. Ist einer eine grobe Sau, literally a rough pig, qui non delectatur cognitione historiarum. Though Gunther of Nordhausen chose less inflammatory language at Erfurt's general chapter, he too readily availed himself of the fairly unflattering comparison between man and beast. Gunther recalled how on his abbatial visitations, an examination undertaken regularly by the Confederation's leading prelates, he had had to catch his breath and, to use his own words, his jaw dropped as the abbots of the monasteries he examined had been unable to give an account of their community's history. They had known nothing, nothing at all, plane nihil, about their monastery's ancient traditions. But averting their gaze and embarrassment, they had remained silent like fish. With the abbots failing comprehensively at the task of historical curation and record keeping, the situation amongst the monks is said to have been just as appalling. Nobody knew anything about the history of his abbey or showed any inclination whatsoever to commit the community's past to writing. Historical study, the Studium Historicum, was conducted in amateurish and piecemeal fashion, if it was practiced at all. According to Gunther, this was entirely unacceptable and unworthy of an abbot's duties. He, who doesn't know the history of his own house, could not possibly govern it well. This had to stop once and for all, and every single abbot present at Erfurt in 1481 was urged to lead by example and champion the writing of history in his own monastery. It is easy to imagine the reactions amongst the accused, which presumably ranged from embarrassing silence to defensive indignation, surprise, disbelief, and quite possibly outrage. Gunther appears to have anticipated strong reactions amongst his abbatial peers, and he responded to them explicitly in his treatise. And I quote, "You might say, where's the abbot supposed to find the time for writing history, given that he is in charge of the monastery's sacred and economic matters? To this I respond, if indeed the abbot cannot make the time to do the writing himself, or does not want to, is it not within his power to allocate the task to someone else within his monastery? If there is nobody suitable in his monastery, can he not commission someone externally to complete the task in a satisfactory way?" It was necessary, Gunther continued his explanation, for a teacher of history, a Doctus Historiarum Magister, to be appointed in every monastery so he could instruct the monks in historical matters at set times of the day. It was not just the junior monks, the juniores, who were in need of such instruction, however, but also the old monks, the seniores, many of whom, according to Gunther, were but uneducated children when it came to historical studies. And yet, even the smallest and most humble monastery had a history worth studying. Gunther then emphasized this point through a series of rhetorical questions. And I quote once again, "Is it not true that every monastery, no matter how big or small, has a founder or a patron? Who were these men and women? Who were their families? And what were their motivations for founding a religious community? What other deeds did they commit, and what gifts and donations did they make to the monks? Who were the abbots and abbesses leading these monasteries over the course of the centuries? How long did they rule? What were the most important achievements of their abbesses? And how did the monastery benefit, or indeed suffer, as a result? Was it not the abbot's duty to create a record of these things to pass down to future generations? Had St. Benedict himself not deliberately exempted the writing of history when discouraging his disciples from pursuing literary endeavours? After all, had man not been created to write history, meaning that it should come naturally to him, just as flying came naturally to the birds in the sky and swimming did to the fish in the sea? What else did the prophets write if not history? What were the four evangelists? What was Moses if not writers of history?" These, Gunther concluded, were the examples that the abbots ought to follow. To ensure that this would be the case, he called upon the Bosfelder congregation and its general chapter to issue a decree committing every abbot to produce or commission a written record of his monastery's history in the shape of annals or chronicles, annales vel historias. Even better, why not ask the Pope in Rome to release a universal mandate according to which every abbot or bishop had to show equal zeal and commitment regarding the historiographical production in his church? Better still, why not petition the Holy Roman Emperor to publish a similar decree, thus binding every last abbot, bishop, and prince throughout his empire to the study and writing of history? Whether or not Gunther ever entertained any real hope for the implementation of these ambitious proposals, they were guaranteed to at least ruffle some feathers amongst those present at Erfurt in 1481. Wishful though some of Gunther's ideas may have seemed at the time, they were not without historical precedent. Particularly the notion of an imperial missive urging the heads of religious communities to improve the standards of learning and writing in their respective churches surely would have rung a distant bell with the treatise's audience, many of whom would have been at least vaguely familiar with the famous letter known as Epistola Deleteris Colendis. Issued in the name of Emperor Charlemagne, the epistola was written during the final quarter of the 8th century, presumably by the learned Anglo-Saxon scholar and teacher at Charlemagne's court, Alcuin of York, and sent to Abbot Baugulf of Fulda, ahead of the more formal legislation enshrined in the 789 capitulary known as the Admonitio Generalis. In this letter, Charlemagne, via his scribe, not only ordered the Abbot of Fulda to ensure a sufficiently high standard of learning and literacy amongst the members of his own monastic community, but he further instructed Baugulf, if he wished to retain the emperor's favour, to make copies of the letter and send them to all the bishops and abbots connected to Fulda, commanding them to do likewise. Today, the Epistola Deleteris Colendis has survived in a single, heavily mutilated copy kept in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, and it is widely recognised as an important witness to the ambitious educational reform agenda that underpinned the so-called Carolingian Renaissance. It is not impossible, and by no means implausible, that Gunther might have had Charlemagne's influential epistola in mind when writing his treatise on the study of history and its usefulness in the early months of 1481. It is this situation at early medieval Fulda that I should like to explore in tonight's lecture, though before we can do so, we must ask a few questions to frame our inquiry. To what extent can we take Gunther's confident assertion that writing history formed an integral part of the abbot's ex officio duties at face value? Is there evidence to suggest that this had been the case historically, not only during the 15th century, but also with regard to the early and central Middle Ages? Where should we as historians be looking for such evidence, and how are we to interpret it? Several obvious lines of inquiry can be discarded from the outset, given that they tell us nothing about the possible relationship between the abbatial office and the responsibilities of a monastic historian. This condition is perhaps most acute with regard to normative texts, first of all, the Rule of St. Benedict and the other monastic rules written during late antiquity and the early medieval period, none of which tells us who, if anyone, was supposed to maintain and oversee the study of history and historiographical production inside the monastic community. In fact, the subject of historical writing is absent altogether from these rules, and the same is true with regard to the monastic constitutions codified during the early and central Middle Ages that survive in the shape of customaries and other kinds of documents. As has recently been observed with regard to 13th century England, within a medieval monastery, and I quote, there was no official position associated with the writing of history, no office of communal recorder of the past. That said, should this absence of formalised regulation concerning the writing of history in a medieval monastic context tempt us to conclude that there were no customs or traditions to that effect? Once we step outside the realm of normative texts, it becomes apparent that abbots writing history were, if not exactly the norm, a relatively frequent phenomenon during the Middle Ages. Over the course of my research project so far, I've been able to identify over 70 examples from the 700-year period between around 800 to 1500, and I'm still regularly discovering new cases to be added to this as of yet incomplete hand list. Whilst this number might not strike us as astronomical, averaging just about one example per decade without taking into account different levels of concentration and particular chronological or geographical clusters, it is still substantial enough to give pause for thought. Why did these abbots pick up the pen to create written records of their community's past? Were they merely doing what was expected of them, or did they break with convention? I would like to stress that my intention in asking these kinds of questions is not to insinuate that abbot historians were a case apart from other types of medieval historians. Nor do I wish to suggest that their writing of history differed fundamentally or categorically from that practiced by their non-abbatial contemporaries. Rather, I aim to explore what difference, if any, it made when a historian was also an abbot and vice versa. What authority, power, resources, and room for manoeuvre did abbots possess with regard to historiographical production that were not, or only in a limited sense, available to other writers of history, both inside and outside the medieval cloister? In the next part of this lecture, I will offer you a case study of one of the earliest abbot historians studied as part of my project, Aegil of Fulda. The monastic community of Fulda, situated in Germany's federal state of Hesse, was founded in 744 by the Anglo-Saxon missionary and Archbishop St. Boniface. Both geographically and culturally, Fulda belonged to what is known among scholars as the so-called Germanic Insular Writing Province, which stretched throughout Hesse and along the River Main as far south as Würzburg. The reason for this moniker is the profound impact of the Anglo-Saxon scribes who had accompanied Boniface on the style of handwriting and artistic decoration in manuscripts produced by monasteries and cathedrals within this region. Driven by pragmatic reform and centralized legislation, such as the Admonitio Generalis and the Epistola de Literis Colendis encountered earlier, most of the Carolingian Empire came to adopt a uniform style of handwriting known as Carolingian or Caroline Minuscule, that within a rather short period of time emancipated itself from the stylistic and aesthetic repertoire of its insular or Anglo-Saxon counterpart. Here are some examples for you on the wall. By contrast, the main centres of literary production within the Germanic insular writing province remain more conservative, as their scribes continued well into the 9th century to practice some of the old handwriting styles brought over by Boniface and his companions, at times combining them with elements of the new Carolingian minuscule to produce a transitional script that found its most distinctive expression at Fulda. And here's an example from a document from early 9th century Fulda. Having overseen the establishment and initial construction of Fulda's monastery personally, Boniface in 744 designated one of his own pupils, named Stormius, as the community's first abbot. The child of a well-connected Bavarian nobleman and his wife, Stormius governed Fulda until his death in 779, though his career was far from smooth. Not only did he spend a considerable amount of time away from his monastery, for example, when studying for 2 years in Rome and Monte Cassino, but he was deposed by the mayor of the palace Pippin in 763 and, as a result, had to spend 2 years in exile at the Norman monastery of Jumièges. After Stormius' death in 779, the abbacy of Fulda went to Baugulf, whom we met earlier as the recipient of Charlemagne's programmatic exhortation letter. Following internal disputes, Baugulf resigned from the abbatial office in 802 and retired to a small monastic cell in Bavaria, which he himself had founded a few years earlier. His successor, Abbot Radger, ruled for 15 years, but he too was deposed and made to retire in 817 as a result of continuous infighting that paralysed the monastic community and split the monks into two rival factions. Today, Radger's abbacy is widely considered one of the most critical and conflicted periods in Fulda's early medieval history that involved not just the monastery and its abbot, but also the bishops of Mainz, Würzburg, Worms and Augsburg, as well as the Emperor Charlemagne and his son and successor Louis the Pious. Radgar's successor, Abbot Aegil, governed the monastery of Fulda from 818 to 822. Like Stormius, Aegil belonged to the Bavarian nobility. In fact, he was a direct relative of Fulda's first abbot. Aegil had entered Fulda as a child, whence he grew up under the successive regiments of abbots Stormius, Baugulf, and Radgar. He was almost certainly amongst the ringleaders who opposed Radgar's regime from the inside and forced his deposition in 802 by means of a collective petition that was presented first to Charlemagne and then to Louis the Pious. Known as the Supplex Libellus, this petition provides unique insights into the dynamics of monastic governance from the perspective not of those who govern, but of those being governed. Not only was Aegil a leading figure in Fulda's monastic grassroots movement, but he probably also had a hand, literally speaking, in drafting the Supplex Libellus. Having joined the monastic community as a boy during the first decade after its foundation, Aegil was elected abbot as an old man of nearly 70 years. Having witnessed and helped shape the monastery's history firsthand for over 6 decades, he was one of the oldest and most experienced members of the community and a key agent in Fulda's collective and institutional memory. Drawing on the work of International Peace Prize laureates Jan and Alaida Assmann, we can distinguish between two forms or formats of collective memory. Communicative memory, which is dynamic and depends on active communication between the living members of a given community, set against the limited temporal horizon of 3 generations, or approximately 80 to 100 years, and cultural memory, which is geared towards longevity and requires the authority of written records handed down from generation to generation. These two formats of memory do not exist in perfect isolation from one another, but are marked by mutual permeability and permutation, thereby creating a field of constant tension between them. It is within this field of tension that history takes place, with one foot in the present and the other in the past, never objective and forever subject to revision, renegotiation and rewriting. When Aegil became abbot of Fulda in 818, there was no shortage of communicative memory. The recollections of the community's oldest members, including Aegil himself, spanned the entirety of the monastery's institutional past, from its very beginnings under Boniface and Stormius to the most recent conflicts that had led to Radgar's deposition. By contrast, the production of written memories or records was underdeveloped during the early 9th century, and historiography in particular was still very much a blank sheet when Aegil began his abbacy. The humble corpus of historical records produced at Fulda under Abbots Stormius, Baugulf and Radgar mainly comprised sporadically updated yearbooks and occasional annotations in the margins of liturgical and or computistic manuscripts such as calendars and Easter tables. The earliest 2 texts from this category were the Annales Fuldenses Antiquissimi and the monk's redaction of the shorter annals of Lorsch Abbey, which were later accompanied by Fulda's local continuation of the Royal Frankish Annals, and the so-called Chronica Fuldensis, which despite its name offers very little in terms of continuous historical narrative. Besides these annalistic works, Fulda's cultural memory and monastic memoria had to rely on a small number of short and often incomplete lists of deceased monks, abbots, patrons and benefactors. Even when combined, these pragmatically oriented texts, while of great value to historians interested in the beginnings of memorial practice and the commemoration of the dead at Fulda, do not amalgamate into a systematic narrative of the monastery's early history and the achievements of its abbots. Their brevity and lack of detail arguably made them deficient for the cultivation of a shared historical consciousness and identity amongst the members of Fulda's monastic community, which is why they have been referred to as an example of history writing at the most local level, intended for private use only. The first works of history written at Fulda to break with this analytic tradition were the lives of its early abbots. The first of these abbatial biographies was dedicated to Sturmius, composed by Aegil himself. In addition to relating the life and the deeds of Fulda's first abbot, Aegil's Vita Sturmi contains a detailed account of the monastery's foundation under St. Boniface in the tradition of the Historia Fundationis, or foundation history, something which had not existed at Fulda previously. Aegil, in his capacity as abbot, did more than simply compose the life of Sturmius, but he also ordered for the work to be read out to the monks gathered in the refectory during mealtimes once every year at the occasion of the protagonist's feast day, an honour typically reserved for works of hagiography and the rule of St. Benedict. The extant library inventories for medieval Fulda list these lives as stored alongside and sometimes on the same shelf as the rule of St. Benedict, which might confirm that they were considered to serve a similar function. One of these medieval library catalogues, dating from the 15th century and found in a manuscript now kept in Basel, Switzerland, lists a long-lost life of St. Boniface, composed by an anonymous monk of Fulda in a mixture of Latin metric verse and prose. Though most scholars confidently date this text within the period of Radger's abbacy, this dating is by no means certain, and it is perfectly possible that the Vita Bonifacii might have been written as late as the mid-9th century, thus post-dating Aegil's Vita Sturmi. The fact that no trace whatsoever is known to survive of this text must prevent us from reaching a firm conclusion either way. And in any case, the life of Sturmius remains the foundational history of Fulda and its first abbot. More important for our purposes, meanwhile, is the dating of Aegil's Vita Sturmi itself, which remains contested even in the most recent scholarship. Traditionally, the Vita was thought to have been written during the final decade of the 8th century, that is, before Aegil became abbot of Fulda, a date which, despite having faced repeated criticism, has been defended time and again by the text's modern editor and translator, Pius Engelbert, and which was adopted wholesale by Walter Berschin in his seminal 1996 article on the writing of history, the writing of biography at Fulda during the Carolingian period. And the table on the wall here is from Walter Berschin's article, and these are the dates that he assumes for the different lives of Fulda's early abbots. Standing in opposition to Engelbert's thesis is a much later date, first proposed by Gerion Bech-Jørgens and corroborated since by Petra Kehl and Janneke Reimerkes, all of whom consider the life of Sturmius to have been composed in or shortly after 820, and therefore after Aegil's appointment as abbot in 818. The evidence produced in support of this later date is both exhaustive and compelling, which is why for the remainder of tonight's lecture, the years around 820 will be accepted as the text's most likely point of composition, rather than the date shown here. Indeed, we may be able to lend further support to this revised dating by turning our attention to the conceptual outlook of the Vita Sturmi and its relationship with the other abbatial biographies written at Fulda in close temporal proximity to Aegil's work, but not by Aegil himself. These are the Vita Baugulfi and the Vita Radgari, dedicated to the lives and deeds of Fulda's second and third abbot,
respectively.
The conditions surrounding the composition of the life of Beowulf are reasonably well established. Given that its author, a learned monk of Fulda named Brun Candidus, informs us elsewhere that he wrote the work at the personal request of his abbot, Aegeon. This means that the Vita cannot possibly have been produced prior to Aegeon's appointment as abbot in 818, though a date shortly after 820 seems more likely. There is, to my knowledge, no evidence to support Bearsheen's rather curious dating of the Vita to after 802, but perhaps we are simply dealing with a typo where the last two digits of the number 820 were inverted by accident. I don't know. Our knowledge regarding the Vita Radgari is much less secure, and we no longer know who wrote the work. Based on contextual evidence, the terminus postquem can be established relatively safely as the year 817 in accordance with Bearsheen's overview, meaning that both the life of Beowulf and the life of Radga were produced during the four short years of Aegeon's abbacy, 818 to 822. Unfortunately, neither text survives today, meaning that we cannot corroborate this date range through textual or paleographical analysis. Nevertheless, or perhaps because of these challenging conditions, I would like to propose a new interpretation concerning the conceptual outlook of both these texts and the life of Stormius that, to the best of my knowledge, has remained overlooked in previous scholarship. Embracing the revised date for the composition of Aegeon's Vita Stormi in the year 820 or thereabouts, as proposed by Bech-Jerms, the biographies of Fulda's first three abbots all appear to have been written in quick succession within a relatively short time span of no more than 4 years, possibly less. If, moreover, we assume that this sequence of composition resembled the abbatial succession of the text's respective protagonists, first Stormius, then Beowulf, then Radge, we may have reason to question Bearsheen's interpretation of Fulda's earliest abbatial biographies as three independently conceived stand-alone works. Indeed, the close thematic and chronological proximity of the three texts gives reason to suspect that when Aegeon wrote the Vita Stormi, he may already have envisaged a continuation of its subject matter in the shape of the Vita Beowulfi and the Vita Radgari, at least one of which we know for certain he himself commissioned from Brun Candidus within a few years, if not months, of completing the life of Stormius. Did Aegeon perhaps aim to produce not so much a standalone history of Fulda's monastic foundation and the deeds of its first abbot, but rather a serial abbatial biography, a Gesta Abbatum Fuldensium? According to Bearsheen, plans to produce a Gesta Abbatum for the abbots of Fulda did not become acute until the first quarter of the 10th century, when a short text composed around 916 and known as the Catalogus Abbatum Fuldensium laid out, in the very briefest of terms, the most memorable deeds of Fulda's first 10 abbots for the memory of posterity. And this is the manuscript of the text. The possible exemplars and models of inspiration for this 10th century Catalogus Abbatum identified by Bearsheen include a selection of earlier Gesta Abbatum written in England, Normandy, France and Switzerland, as well as the famous serial biography of the Roman popes, known as the Liber Pontificalis. Experiencing widespread dissemination and adaptation throughout Latin Europe during the early and central Middle Ages, the Liber Pontificalis became genre-defining for a large number of medieval biographical writings, recording the sequential lives and deeds of popes, bishops, abbots, kings, princes, and even emperors. It would not be a huge surprise, therefore, if the anonymous 10th century compiler of Fulda's Catalogus Abbatum had been looking to the Liber Pontificalis for inspiration, and Berchin's arguments to that effect remain convincing. Meanwhile, a question that Berchin did not ask, but which is of crucial relevance to the arguments of this lecture, is whether the Liber Pontificalis had been known at Fulda prior to the 10th century, and if indeed it had been, whether it might have provided inspiration for Fulda's earliest abbatial biographies written during the 1820s. Returning to the later medieval library catalogue introduced earlier, a copy of the Liber Pontificalis was certainly at Fulda by the 15th century, and three later book lists drawn up during the 16th century and now kept at the Vatican, the State Archives in Marburg, and the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris all serve to confirm the work's presence amongst the books gathered in the monastery's early modern library. In these later medieval and early modern catalogues, the Liber Pontificalis is called Actus Episcoporum Romanorum, whilst the 15th century inventory lists it as Liber in quo nomina Romanorum Pontificum et gesta Henrici Imperatoris, which suggests that this copy of the Liber Pontificalis formed a composite manuscript also including an account of the deeds of Emperor Henry, whichever Henry that might have been. Likely candidates are Adalbert of Bamberg's Vita Henrici Secundi, composed around 1040 to 1060, the Gesta Henrici Quinti, compiled in the first decade of the 14th century, and the deeds of Henry VI by Geoffrey of Viterbo, written around 1202. In either case, the manuscript, and thus the copy of the Liber Pontificalis contained therein, could not have been produced prior to the mid-11th century. Unless, of course, the composite codex incorporated an earlier manuscript, or parts thereof, previously owned at Fulda. For now, this must remain speculation. Meanwhile, there are two pieces of evidence to suggest that the Liber Pontificalis was, if not owned, then at least known at Fulda in the period of Aegil's abbacy, if not earlier. The first piece of evidence is a copy of the Liber Pontificalis in a manuscript made at Fulda during the later 11th century and kept today at the University Library in Leiden in the Netherlands, which reveals strong connections with the Carolingian period. Copied alongside the Liber Pontificalis in the Leiden manuscript are several earlier texts written at Fulda, for example, a martyrology and necrology, a list of its abbots continued up to 1096, as well as, crucially, the so-called Ancient Annals of St. Boniface, really a yearbook of Fulda, which despite its name was likely produced around 820, as shown by Eckhard Freise. Whilst we do not know from which exemplar or exemplars the Leiden copy was made, it is possible that these exemplars had been amongst the books in Fulda's early medieval library. The presence of the Annals of St. Boniface, compiled during Aegil's abbacy and thus strictly contemporary with the lives of Sturmius, Baubef and Radger, might further suggest that these exemplars had been at Fulda since the early decades of the 9th century. Whether they included a copy of the Liber Pontificalis is difficult to know, but it remains a possibility. The second piece of evidence allows us to be more assertive. It is found in a manuscript we encountered in the first part of tonight's lecture, the same manuscript that contains the only surviving copy of Charlemagne's epistola De Litteris Colendis to Abbot Baugulf of Fulda. Whilst the epistola occupies the book's opening page, the last page of the manuscript carries another text written around the same time. Formatted in two vertical columns, we have here the earliest known book list from the Cathedral Library of St. Killian's in Würzburg, dated paleographically to around the year 800. As we will remember, Würzburg and Fulda were the most important centres of the so-called Germanic Insular Writing Province, and sure enough, there are unmistakable signs of Anglo-Saxon scribal influence in the book list's handwriting. Look at the G here, for example, but also some of the descenders on various letter forms, as well as the execution of these E's. Upon closer inspection, we can see that the 14th title in the list's left-hand column is none other than the Liber Pontificalis, referred to here as Episcopal, a title used not infrequently during the 8th and early 9th centuries for the work. And there is more. Not only does the list testify to the presence of the Liber Pontificalis at Würzburg a good 20 years before Aedil's appointment as abbot of Fulda, but it also contains concrete evidence to suggest that the monks of Fulda might have had access to this book. Turning to the books listed in the right-hand column, a mirror or speculum written by St. Augustine, Gregory the Great's homilies, the Old Testament Book of Proverbs, and a copy of the Beatitudinis, we learn that when the list was drawn up, these books were not actually at Würzburg, but had been sent at Fultu to Fulda. Not only did Fulda's monks know what books were available at Würzburg around the year 800, but they had established a system by which they could borrow these books temporarily, either for reading or in order to produce copies for their own in-house library. A medieval interlibrary loan system, so to speak. We know of several exemplars that found their way from Würzburg to Fulda, or vice versa, during the period in question. And although the Liber Pontificalis mentioned in the left-hand column was not at Fultu around 800, there's nothing to suggest that did not make this journey at some point. For example, to be used by Aedil as a model of inspiration for the biographies of Fulda's earliest abbots. If the Liber Pontificalis did provide inspiration for the conceptual outlook of Aedil's work, it would have given Fulda's Gesta Abbatum a decidedly Roman or Romanesque flavour. Indeed, if there was one major cultural theme and leitmotif at Fulda during the Carolingian period, it was the imitation of Rome. This imitation can be detected not just in Fulda's literary production, but throughout its cultural and architectural landscape, most prominently perhaps in the construction and ornamentation of its churches. Given the constraints of time and the happy fact that these architectural and art historical sources have been researched and published at great length, I will only mention a few selected examples. These include, first and foremost, the great Carolingian Abbey Church of Fulda, constructed under Abbot Baugulf and expanded under his successor Radger. The church's floor plan and architectural features are an almost perfect imitation of the papal basilica of Old St. Peter in Rome, which until the 16th century stood in the place now occupied by its Renaissance successor at the Piazza San Pietro, to the point that Fulda's medieval master builders sent to Rome for the exact measurements of the church they were seeking to emulate. When they received the measurements, however, Abbot Radger and his architects failed to realise that their Mediterranean associates had done them a courtesy by converting the numbers from Roman feet to Carolingian feet in recognition of the different linear units used south and north of the Alps. Inadvertently converting the same measurements for a second time, Fulda's master builders erected an abbey church whose western transept was an exact replica of its Roman counterpart, except that it was about 12 metres too short. Though the details of its constructions were lost in translation, Radger's majestic basilica at Fulda still represented the most faithful imitation of Old St. Peter built north of the Alps during the Carolingian period. Unlike the vast majority of medieval churches, Fulda's basilica was not oriented towards the east, but instead had its primary apse and altar facing westwards, in analogy to Old St. Peter. And just like the papal basilica in Rome, Fulda's new abbey church was given separated annexes at the northern and southern ends of its transept, these here, as well as an eastern atrium with a generous foyer, which later was converted into a Capella Regis. When Aegild succeeded Radger as abbot in 818, he continued and expanded his predecessor's Rome-centred building campaign by adding two new crypts to Fulda's abbey church, one of which received the venerated remains of St. Boniface. Just like the tomb of St. Peter in Rome, Boniface's crypt at Fulda was constructed in such a way as to allow pilgrims to worship the saint's body even during Mass, thereby emphasising Boniface's apostolic succession from St. Peter as Bishop of Mainz. Aegild further relocated the remains of his predecessor and relative Stormius into the basilica's southern aisle, associating it closely with the altar dedicated to St. Ignatius of Antioch, a pupil of St. Peter, who as Bishop of Antioch had claimed the second highest rank within the early Christian church, second only to Rome herself. In addition, Aegild constructed a second church within the monastic precinct, no more than a stone's throw away from the main basilica. Located in the abbey's graveyard and dedicated to St. Michael, this sepulchral church features a full-size crypt designed to accommodate a large number of graves. Telling by the church's unusual round design and the tituli Aegild had composed for its altars, written by none other than Brun Candidus, author of The Life of Beowulf, it had been designed as an imitation of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. The crypt, which occupies the entire space beneath the ground floor and features its own altar, was intended to provide the final resting place for Fulda's future abbots. To initiate this new tradition, Aegild, upon his death in 822, requested for his own body to be buried in the eastern section of the crypt behind the altar. Unfortunately, none of his successors followed suit, and even today, Aegild's remains no longer occupy the sarcophagus he designed and designated for himself. To my knowledge, the body's whereabouts remain unknown. Through these building campaigns, Aegild claimed apostolic succession for both Fulda's founding figures, Boniface and Stormius, in a way that was perfectly plausible according to medieval hagiographical conventions. A similar accentuation of Fulda's Roman heritage can be detected in Aegild's Life of Stormius, where we learn that Stormius had left Fulda for 2 years to study in Italy. But unlike in other contemporary sources, such as the aforementioned Supplex Libellus, there curiously is no mention whatsoever of the abbot's visit to Monte Cassino. Instead, we only hear of Stormius's time in Rome. Is it possible that Aegild had intended to depict Stormius first and foremost as a Roman abbot? And might that be why the Vita Stormi glosses over Monte Cassino? After all, such a Rome-centred depiction of Fulda first abbot would have chimed well with the fact that the monastery of Fulda had been the first church north of the Alps to be subjected directly and exclusively to the authority of the Roman popes, thereby exempting it from the control of kings, emperors, and bishops. When studied in the context of Aegild's other abbatial activities, particularly his architectural campaigns, the Life of Stormius no longer appears as an isolated writing project. Instead, it emerges as an integral tile within a large and multifaceted mosaic that reveals Aegild as an abbot with an ambitious and sophisticated historical vision. A vision which was expressed in writing as much as it manifested itself in material ways. As Fulda's abbot, Aegild himself acted as a writer of history by producing the Vita Stormi, but he also commissioned other members of the monastery to write similar works. Contrary to prevailing scholarly opinion, Aegild's historiographical vision and ambition were not exhausted by the Life of Stormius, but, as I hope to have shown tonight, gave rise to a much larger literary oeuvre. Rather than constituting a standalone work, the Vita Stormi ushered in a serial biography of Fulda's early abbots, the Gesta Abbatum Fuldensium, which also included Stormius' successors, Beowulf and Radgar. The Vita Beowulfi and Vita Radgari were thus not an afterthought to the life of Stormius, but they had likely been part of Aegil's conceptual outlook from the very beginning. As an elderly man in his late 60s, who after a lifetime dedicated to serving the monastic community he had joined as a child, was appointed as its abbot, Aegil presumably had neither the time nor the energy to complete the entirety of his ambitious historiographical project himself. But then again, he did not have to. After all, writing history in a medieval monastery was rarely, if ever, the task of a single person working in perfect isolation, but more often than not, it was a collective activity, a communal duty that involved collaboration at the same time as requiring leadership, authority and guidance on the part of an individual acting as the project's intellectual architect. As abbot of Fulda, Aegil possessed both the authority to take on this role of intellectual architect and the resources to delegate certain activities to others. One of these people was the learned monk Brun Candidus, whom Aegil commissioned to write the continuation of his Vita Stormi in the form of the life of Beowulf. As one of the oldest members of Fulda's monastic community, Aegil had been around almost since its foundation. He had known all three of his predecessors personally, had been a first-hand witness of their achievements, but also of their failures, and in the case of Radgar, he had even played a part in an abbot's deposition. As a guardian of Fulda's collective and cultural memory, Aegil, during his short but productive abbacy, embarked on a large-scale project that comprised not just a series of historical writings authored by himself and others, but also a range of architectural campaigns, including the completion of the basilica and the construction of a sepulchral church designed to host the tombs of Fulda's future abbots. As modern historians, we need to learn not to treat these historical sources and artifacts in isolation, but recognize them as conceptual units that were meant to speak both to one another and to others. Each of the buildings and each of the texts produced and commissioned by Aegil during the years 818 to 820 constitutes an important and deliberate site of memory, and together they combine into a carefully crafted historiographical landscape. Using his position as abbot and drawing upon the authority and resources made available to him, Aegil acted as this landscape's intellectual architect. And in so doing, he himself took on the role of the Doctus Historiarum Magister that Gunther of Nordhausen demanded to be installed in every monastery by the abbots gathered at the General Chapter in Erfurt in 1481. Thank you very much.